Good day out there, podcast land. I'm your host, Gary Zabinski, and you're listening to another edition of Talk Sports, where my sidekick and friend, Roscoe. How are you, Roscoe?
I'm terrific.
Fantastic. We're going to explore some adventures in the lively art of conversation. And for some of our listeners out there, I'd just like to reiterate kind of what we do here. We'll be talking about recent, sometimes esoteric topics, often employing the viewpoints and wisdom of some friends and colleagues. We've got some visitors from Bridgeport and from Whiting, Indiana, who might weigh in. And we'll be matching wits with some artists and friends here in our native Chicago. There'll be plenty of Chi-Town hijinks as well, with a segment we call Roscoe at Large, sort of a man about town or about the street piece, where we'll send Roscoe, sometimes myself, to some of the more exotic places and events in this great metropolis to hear what's going on. In fact, we recently went to the Chicago Flower and Garden Show, and we had a nice recording of that. That was a fun time. We'll be doing more of that.
It was one of the high points of 2015 for me, were the few hours we spent at Navy Pier.
I'm not sure if that's sad or just a cool thing.
Well, it's something we can talk about.
We can.
It's both sad and cool.
We'll discuss the state and the health of Chicago theater, music, art, ballet on a regular basis. And there'll be a few surprise guests along the way. And who knows, we might actually talk about some sports, too.
Horrors.
You've been boning up.
I've been boning up.
It's a great sports time in Chicago,
isn't it? It's an incredible sports time in
Chicago. Baseball, Blackhawks, Bulls. Things going on everywhere.
Hockey.
That's the Blackhawks.
Oh, that's the Blackhawks. Dick the Bruiser just died last week.
So far, you're doing very well on the sports conversation.
Are the White Sox still playing?
Yeah, of course they're playing. Okay. This is the beginning of the season.
No one talks about the White Sox.
Yeah, well, there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
So grab a cocktail and enjoy. Are you ready to play, Roscoe?
I'm ready to play.
Fantastic. We got a lot to cover today. We should get right to it.
Oh, my God. That's right to it fast. This is going to be a full
big
hour.
Big news. First thing I want to talk about right off the bat. The Gay Pride Parade may be leaving Boys Town and the Near North Side. Have you read about this?
No.
Did you know that the aldermen in the district there are very upset about the Yahooligans, as our friend George from Midlothian would say? Now, you've been to the Gay Pride Parade.
I have. Not on a regular basis in many years, but...
Do you find it to be full of... drunken whores wandering the streets?
Did you say drunken whores?
No, but that too.
What did you say? Drunks?
Hordes.
Oh, drunken hordes. Oh, my Lord. Oh, my Lord. This is why you need to have your headphones at optimum volume.
It's true.
Here's the deal with the Gay Pride Parade. Very popular for many years. Huge crowd. I think it started at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and it would go through the what's known as now known as Boys Town in Chicago. Then was just Anders, Lakeview, and wild, crazy, half naked people. They've cleaned it up in recent years. Now everyone in the world goes. It's the Gay Pride Parade, but probably most of the crowd is straight. You know, the every corporation has a float. And what they've tried to do to deal with the drunkenness is to move it earlier and earlier and earlier. So it now starts at 11 o'clock in the morning before the bars are even open. Alcohol is strictly forbidden on the parade route. They still can't control it. It's the second largest parade, the second most popular parade in Chicago. Isn't that right?
I think, right after the St. Patrick's Day parade.
Yeah, it gets more than a million people. And it starts near where I live. And I walked down to the parade route at Montrose and Broadway.
Yeah, last year it went from West Montrose Avenue to the corner of West Diversity Parkway and North Sheridan Road.
And you would have thought the Pope Mobile was going to come down the street because of the hordes. And within 5 minutes, I saw the governor of Illinois, the mayor of Chicago, our aldermen, anyone who's ever run for an elected office. The crowds are amazing, but it's too large for the neighborhood.
Yeah,
it's too large for the streets.
44th Ward Alderman and 46th Ward Alderman, respectively, Tom Tunney and James Kappelman, are quoted as saying, "If there's not a serious improvement in the parade's impact on surrounding residents' quality of life this year, the next step is to assemble an advisory group to make recommendations for moving the parade out of the Lakeview community." Well, where would it go?
Downtown.
Evanston?
Evanston. Let's have a Chicago Gay Pride Parade in Evanston.
Kenilworth. Kenilworth seems like a nice place.
It'll be the most exciting thing that's happened there in years.
In 2014, Pride Parade drew hundreds of thousands of attendees. 8 people were arrested for event-related activities, according to the Tribune, Chicago Tribune. One was charged with criminal damage to property for allegedly jumping up and down on top of a Chicago police squad car, denting the roof. And they said that this year's parade, which will be on June 28th this year, will be subject to a stricter public safety standards, including more enforcement of laws against drinking in public. Well, I just think it's gotten out of control.
They're going to have to pull out the National Guard to get that anymore. Every Chicago police officer is now at the Gay Pride Parade.
But they won't know who's an actual National Guard person and who's just a gay man dressed in fatigues.
Oh, my God, that would be fantastic.
That's true.
Perhaps I will show up in a National Guard uniform.
Now, moving from that to... What would you do if you had a product and you were going to do an expo about this product, but the product was very not mainstream and a little offensive, but you were going to do an expo for it? Entries are piling up for a slogan contest being held this year by the North American Manure Expo. Have you read about this?
No.
Yeah. The trade show, now in its 13th year, that's unfortunate.
Could we go to the manure trade show?
Yeah, we may. Showcases the latest technology in manure handling, treatment, and application. It's being held in July in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. I think that would be a lovely field trip for us to do.
It would be.
The official event slogan has already been settled on. It's 2015 Manure Expo, manure that you can handle. And that'll appear on the front of a T-shirt. But contestants are vying to land a spot on the back of the T-shirt, which event organizers say will display 10 of the quote-unquote crappiest also-rans. Writers of the 10 alternative slogans get a free T-shirt. So many entries, you know, contain a vulgar substitute for manure, but, you know, they're not going to put that on the back of the T-shirt. So here are 10 printable entries from the approximately 200 that were submitted. Manure Expo, where nobody stands behind their product. Second one was, you provide the creek, we provide the paddle.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Keep your friends close and your manure farther. Here's another one. The future of what's left behind. I think that would be cool on the back of a T-shirt. Oh. Manure happens to be nutritious.
Nutritious?
Been there, spread that at the North American Manure Expo. Not bad. Proud survivor of the North American Manure Expo, it got deep. Heaping piles of fun. And the North American crapshoot.
Help me out here. What is the commercial use for manure? Fertilizer?
Fertilizer, I suppose. Yeah, that's probably the most noticeable usage for manure. And, you know, there's a lot of it. There's cows and pigs and sheep and things everywhere, and they got to do something with all of that stuff. I just thought that of all the obscure expos in the world.
And why would you go? I mean, I do what for a living that's going to inspire me to go to a manure exposition?
And why can't we get this at McCormick Place?
Why not? Absolutely.
Chambersville, Pennsylvania? What do they have that we don't have?
They probably have cheap hotel rooms and non-union expo centers.
And good access to manure.
Yes.
I would think.
You know, in Seattle, they have regular days where they give away to the general. You just show up with a wheelbarrow or something, and they collect all the manure at the zoo. And you can, you know, I can take home and line my geranium beds with ostrich feces if I chose to.
Or like elephant manure.
Or elephant manure, yes.
That would be awesome.
Yes, it makes the geraniums a little redder, I've heard.
I'm sure that's why.
We could do experiments with, like, what kind of manure, results of, ostrich manure versus elephant manure versus reindeer manure, and how that affects plant life. And
why don't we start that as a science project?
All right.
And we could track that during our podcast during the year, and we can report on that regularly.
I'll write that down. We could report on that by the end of the summer if we got started.
Yeah, work on that.
All right, I'm going to add that to my list.
You know who Ayn Rand is, right?
Yes.
For those of our listeners who don't know who Ayn Rand is, she was a Russian-American novelist, philosopher, playwright, screenwriter. She is known for her 2 best-selling novels, The Fountainhead and something that probably everybody knows, Atlas Shrugged. and for developing the philosophical system she called objectivism, describing its essence as the concept of man as a heroic being with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life, with productive achievement as his noblest activity, and reason as his only absolute and aesthetics. Controversial to say the least, she's been embraced recently by the Republican Party, and I believe that Atlas Shrugged has become a must-read if you're on the right side of the aisle these days. I was looking through a recent New Yorker, and Mallory Ortberg wrote a little column, not really about Ayn Rand, but it's Ayn Rand reviews children's movies.
Is Rand Paul named for her?
That's a good question.
I've always wondered this. And is she really embraced by the Republican Party?
She
or,
is.
Or is that an assertion?
No, it absolutely is. In fact, recently, they've asked most of their followers to read.
Are you
Atlas
serious?
Shrugged.
Because yeah. I, you know, I had said earlier in the discussion that getting into politics was probably beyond my purview as someone who can't really talk about anything other than theater or film. But Paul Ryan, you know, was a big supporter of Ayn Rand's philosophies, and spoke at a convention, an Ayn Rand convention, as little as 2 years before he ran for vice president. And since then, he's tried to distance himself and say, "Oh no, I've really put that away, and that was my youth. You know, I was very young then, 38, and really hadn't developed as a thinker or a compassionate human being.
38,
you skip something like that. You know, for my money, without going into it, her preaching is really antithetical to. It's the opposite of Christianity. It's the opposite of what Jesus talked about. Guys, now I'm getting into Christianity. We're not even 10 minutes into our broadcast.
We have talked about religion and politics.
Religion
so far.
And politics.
And we haven't even
gotten to Carousel or the ballet.
True. Well, Mallory Ortberg decided
I'm
undertake
I'm
something.
I'm nearly a sidekick here, and I'm taking over. Please continue,
and she
Mr.
Wrote
host.
She wrote some fictional children's movies reviews that Ayn Rand may have done. So she says of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, "An industrious young woman neglects to charge for her housekeeping services and is rightly exploited for her naivete. She dies without ever having sought her own happiness as the highest moral aim. I did not finish watching this movie, finding it impossible to sympathize with the main character." No stars. Bambi, however, "The biggest and the strongest are the fittest to rule. This is the way things have always been." 4 stars. Old Yeller. You remember Old Yeller.
Oh.
Ayn Rand's review of Old Yeller. "A farm animal ceases to be useful and is disposed of humanely. A valuable lesson for children." 4 stars. Lady and the Tramp. I love Lady and the Tramp. I haven't seen Lady and the Tramp in years.
Peggy Lee wrote the music.
Ayn Rand calls it a ridiculous movie. What could a restaurant owner possibly have to gain by giving away a perfectly good meal to dogs when he could sell it at a reasonable price to human beings? A dog cannot pay for spaghetti, and payment is the only honest way to express appreciation for value. 1 star. She says of Mary Poppins, "A woman takes a job with a wealthy family without asking for money in exchange for her services. An absurd premise. Later, her employer leaves a lucrative career in banking in order to play a children's game." No stars there either. How the Grinch Stole Christmas. "Taxation is also a form of theft. In a truly free society, citizens should pay only as much as they are willing for the services they require." 3 stars. She loved the Grinch.
Wow.
Willy Wonka. "An excellent movie. The obviously unfit individuals are winnowed out through a series of entrepreneurial tests. And in the end, an enterprising young boy receives a factory. I believe more movies should be made about enterprising young boys who are given factories." 3.5 stars. She gets 0.5 star off for the grandparents who are sponging off the labor of Charlie and his mother. If Grandpa Joe can dance, Grandpa Joe can work. Finally, she says of Frozen, very recent film, "An exceptional woman foolishly allows her mooching family members to keep her from ruling a kingdom of ice in perfect solitude. She is forced to use her unique powers to provide free entertainment for peasants without compensation." I liked the snowman. 1 star. I was tickled pink by all of that.
You know, I have a story about her. If you want to see her live and in person, she did not do much publicity. She shied from the public eye. And inexplicably, in the early 1970s, she was a guest on the Merv Griffin Show. Have you ever seen this clip?
I may have.
Yeah, and she he talks to her about her ideas and what she was preaching and how she saw the world, and she refuses to back off of anything, and the audience is stunned. Every time she says one of her crazy things about the survival of the fittest and don't care about the poor because they will only bring you down, there are gasps from the audience. And the audience is incredulous. And then 40 years later, we have a party embracing her teachings.
Well, there are a lot of people who did embrace her teachings even back in the 50s and 60s. This was she became very popular for these novels and her ideas of objectivism. I want to follow up on something we talked about extensively last week. You went to see Carousel for the third time.
I did, at the Lyric Opera.
Why?
Well, a number of reasons. Well, I'll tell you, Carrie, why I went to see Carousel for the third time. Not the best production of Carousel that one will ever see in terms of direction, choreography, staging. However, the best cast that money can buy. Probably the only time I will ever see that show with a full 50 chorus members on stage, 37 pieces in the orchestra pit, I believe. No expense spared, down to the smallest role. Tony Roberts, who's had a distinguished career in film and theater for 50 years, is on stage for all of 5 minutes as the star keeper, you know, a tiny little role. The voices were thrilling. The music was thrilling. Every song in that, you know, if there are 12 songs in the musical, 10 of them are classics. This time I sat 30 rows back, and I could really appreciate the beauty of the sets and the sound problems that I griped about earlier. It didn't exist 30 rows back because of the amplification. So I was thrilled yet again. The pacing was a little slow, but maybe it's because I'd seen the story for the third time. It's like, oh, for God's sakes, just, you know, get to it.
Well,
I wanted to say faster, louder, funnier.
Yeah,
just get to the next song.
As I said, I decided I better go, and I decided I better go, not only from what you said the last time we were together.
Well, I'm going to take issue with this, because I talked about this repeatedly, and you had no intention of going, and it wasn't until you read the New York Times review that you decided you finally had to go. So I was a little hurt that Christopher Isherwood, who you don't know, inspired you to go, but I didn't.
Yeah, I don't care.
No. Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
I went because after this
harsh
whole review at the end, he says, but with the superb singing on display, I'm beginning to feel like a churl for citing any flaws. And I completely agree with all of the observations you made about the show itself and the cast and the music. Well worth seeing. A chance to hear this cherished score delivered with such ample vocal and musical resources should not be missed by anyone who remains entranced by the unique appeal of the great Broadway musicals. Had you said that to me, I probably would have gone on your advice. But we talked about a bunch of the kind of peccadillos and flaws in the show. And I've seen the show before. I stage managed this production once one summer in a very good production, and I didn't think I needed to see it again. But I decided I would go so I could have at least the experience that you have. And I agree completely. Not the greatest ever production of the show, probably, but maybe the best stage production you're going to see in your lifetime.
Here's a question. When Billy stabs himself, did he fall in slow motion off of a roof?
He did.
Ah, the second time I saw it, he didn't. They changed the staging, and I think it's because he was under the weather.
It was one of my quibbles with the staging. Not only had you kind of told me about it, but there's a weird section there where it takes place at the edge of the waterfront, mm-hmm, near this warehouse with barrels and crates and whatever. And at one point, during the action's happening and the police are coming and they've been caught trying to rob the guy who runs the factory of the money that he's bringing back or bringing to the ship. It's all very confusing.
It's payroll.
And Billy Bigelow disappears for a good 30 seconds behind these giant crates. And what's happening is they're hooking him up to this harness so that he can get flown up to the top of the roof and then walk down in slow motion and crash to the bottom. And then when he crashes to the bottom, he disappears behind a bunch of crates again for about 30 seconds before they drag him out dead. I'm going, la, 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 la. Is that really worth this? I mean, couldn't they?
And it sort of took you out of the story, didn't it? Because yeah. I'm thinking, what's happening? How is he falling in slow motion?
If you were to ask me what else was going on anywhere on that gigantic stage while that little bit was happening, I couldn't tell you.
Right, because all you think about there. Is, wow, how did they do that?
I remarked on this last time on our podcast, one of my favorite shows of all time, The Fantastics, closing. Again. After 20,000 performances.
However,
it's reopened.
It's reopening. It's not closing after all.
The Fantastics, whose cast includes Max Crumb and Samantha Bruce right now, has had a near-death experience before. In 2002, it closed after 17,162 performances over 42 years. It reopened in 2006. But two individual longtime fans of the show have come forward indicating that they will contribute financially to keep the show going, and the producer has accepted their offer. Didn't I tell you that it would reopen? It would survive?
You were prescient, yes.
It's unbelievable. I couldn't be happier about that. I think next time we're in New York together, we need to go see this show. I'm not sure if you've ever seen a live performance of Fantastics or not. Have you?
Must you shame me on the air? You are, in fact, correct.
We had a near brush with greatness earlier this week. We went to something last weekend. Do you remember what that was? Jesus Christ Superstar.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. That was a week ago today.
We were at the Theo Ubique Theater in Rogers Park to see their production of Jesus Christ Superstar, which has gotten fantastic reviews and extended its run. We were lucky enough to get in there. Of course, there's only about, 75 seats.
And this is the thing, without putting too fine a point on it, this is the great thing about Chicago. One day you can go to the Lyric Opera House and see Carousel in the most extravagant possible production in a house that seats 3,500 people. And a week later, we're going to see Jesus Christ Superstar in the most minimalist production possible.
With a four-piece band.
With a four-piece band in a space that seats 50 people squeezed together watching a terrific cast.
I'm not sure which one I enjoyed more.
For sheer pleasure, I have to say Superstar.
Really?
Yes.
I have quibbles with both, but certainly I had a great time doing both of those things. And
should you talk about our waitress/Mary Magdalene?
So at the Theo Ubique Theater,
an unfortunate
which is,
name.
An unfortunate name. Very hard to pronounce. It's a combination of two Latin words, Theo meaning God and Ubique meaning everywhere. So God is everywhere.
Which is great if you work there, but if you're trying, you know, every time I mention the show, someone says, oh, where is it playing? I go, well, it's on Glenwood and it's unique theater. It's something. And then I have to turn on my mobile device and look it up. Theater Ubique, if you're listening to us, change your name for the love of God.
Well, they titled themselves as Cabaret Theater, and indeed it's a real cabaret space. These performers are virtually right on top of you. You might as well be sitting in your living room and have a full-scale production of Phantom of the Opera happening just on the other side of your cocktail table.
Did they knock into your chairs? Frequently, I was knocked into by Pontius Pilate and Jesus as they were trying to make it to their way to the stage.
One character playing a prostitute, she actually propositioned me at one point during the show. And Jesus stood so close to me during one little segment that I almost reached out to touch his robe.
Wow.
Because I wanted that kind of healing power.
You might have been healed.
Or
you might have been thrown out.
Now, at the Theater Ubique, you can
creepy
also
audience
have,
member in, touches Jesus.
Indeed. You can also order dinner beforehand. We did not do that. We came fed. But the dinner was some sort of
lamb
loin, and it was gray on the outside and slightly blue on the inside. Oh. I saw somebody at another table having some. Glad that we did not do that. It's always come come fed if you're going to Theo Ubuque. That's my advice.
They'll appreciate that we talked about this.
And the show was quite enjoyable.
Talk about Mary Magdalene.
Mary Magdalene. Well, we're sitting there, and we get a waitress over to order some drinks. We had a nice little cocktail table. We had really booth one.
When you're famous
location
podcasters, can you expect anything less? Are they going to stick us in the balcony or force us to sit on stools?
They
with
try,
the
and I said, do you know who I am? And so then we got a very nice table. Our waitress comes over and asks if we want something from the bar. And she was quite tall, very striking. So we order a round of cocktails. And then Betsy opens up the program to see if this is anybody we might know. And indeed, our waitress is Mary Magdalene. Her name is Danny. And she could not have been sweeter and nicer.
Or more talented.
The first act number, she was fantastic in. And then she comes over during intermission to serve us more cocktails. And we're like, you're fantastic. I hope your second act goes really well. Of course, there were no costume changes in the show. There were a few costume pieces that characters put on now and then to become one of the Pharisees or to become an apostle or a soldier or something like that.
They didn't even have room for Jesus to have a cross at the end.
And my big quibble of the night was when they were flogging Jesus, I could see his jockey underwear. And they were blue. And I was pulled completely out of the experience. And then I realized he was wearing Wrangler jeans because I could see the label of the back of his jeans. They were white jeans, but still. Little things like that kind of took me out of the whole absorption of the evening. But they were wonderful. It was a really fun evening. The band, the four-piece band, was tremendous.
Sensational.
And they had a replacement sub drummer on that night. And the musical director who played the piano looked very nervous before the show. They were rehearsing a little bit before the show. And it turned out to be just fantastic. Really quite a fun experience. But you're right. You can go to the Lyric Opera and spend $200 and watch Carousel, where no expense was spared. Or you could spend $35 and go see Jesus Christ Superstar at the Theo Ubuque, less than 10 miles away, maybe, and have just as good an experience, if not even better.
Right, and not to beat a dead horse, but this is how small and minimalist this was. When I got up to use the restroom, there were backpacks on the floor of the restroom because the cast had nowhere to put their things.
This is what was part of their changing area.
Yeah, they were, and look at the finances of this. I mean, these kids worked their butts off.
It was a cast of 13
us.
Or 14.
So
plus
how does the money work with this? Do they make any money at all?
The theater or the
actors? Are they just showing up to do this for the love of wanting to perform? Our Mary Magdalene had won 2 Jeff Awards.
What do you think they make? $50 a show?
Oh no, probably $15 a show. They're probably making $50 a weekend.
No.
Do the math. If there's 50 people in the house and our tickets are $40-some. That's what, a gross of $2,000 for a performance?
Yeah.
And they have to pay rent, they have to pay the staff, they have to pay the electricity, the advertising. Not a lot of money left over.
Royalties.
Because Andrew Lloyd Webber.
That Andrew Lloyd Webber don't work for free.
That's right. He needs the money.
That Tim Rice needs that money probably even more.
Yes.
Indeed. Well, it was a fun evening, and I appreciated you coming with us. We had a great time. Did we talk about this once before, James Earl Jones and Cicely Tyson doing the gin game on Broadway?
I don't think we did.
Well, they're going to be doing the gin game on Broadway. She's 90. He's 84. Do you think they're going to make it through eight shows a week?
That Cicely Tyson is amazingly resilient. I just saw James Earl Jones in the revival of You Can't Take It With You on Broadway, and he's an old man. But he's a sturdy old man. He doesn't sound like Darth Vader anymore. But, has the timing. He's all there. He's sharp. He's agile. He's more agile than I am, probably, and which is not saying a lot. I've talked to my physical therapist. But James Earl Jones and Cicely Tyson, that's thrilling.
They have three Tony Awards between them.
Right, well, she should have every award known to mankind. I saw her in a I think I did opine about her performance in A Trip to the Beautiful a few seasons ago.
Bountiful.
What did I say?
Trip to Beautiful.
A Trip to Beautiful, the Carole King Cicely Tyson musical. But she was thrilling. And has there ever been a show on Broadway which starred someone who's 90 years old who could make it through 8 shows a week?
Well, there's Cheetah Rivera. But
I think we talk about Cheetah Rivera in every single podcast.
We might. We might have to change.
But it's worth it because one day we will no longer be able to speak of Cheetah Rivera.
And then this will all be for posterity and it'll be legendary, these podcasts. Dr. Zhivago closed.
Poor Carly Simon's sister.
After what? Five performances?
Yes.
Joe Allen, here we come.
Dr. Zhivago, the musical, which is based not on the novel Dr. Zhivago, but on the movie. And the worst reviews possible.
And it's taken about, what, 6 years for this to get to Broadway?
I think longer.
It's someone's love child.
Workshopping it forever. And the music and lyrics were by, or is it just the composer, Lucy Simon, Carly Simon's sister, who wrote Secret Garden more than 20 years ago. Mm. And this was her next thing, and it didn't work out. Mm. It's heartbreaking.
It's a little heartbreaking.
it's a little heartbreaking, but awfully funny.
In a Schadenfreude sort of way.
Yes.
This is what I'm saying. These are the things, we kind of relish these. The great hits as well as the gigantic flops. There's a reason.
I wish I could see it just to say I saw it.
It's too late. You'd have to leave.
Oh, it closes tomorrow.
You'd have to leave right now.
I'm leaving.
Goodbye,
right.
Ross.
This podcast is over.
I'm going to
the final Dr. Zhivago performance.
Gotta go. Speaking of Dr. Zhivago and near catastrophes, how about this fire on the roof of the Writers' Theater building that they're creating up there in Glencoe? I think everybody's okay, right?
Yeah, I think so. We need to fill people in. Writers' Theater is in Glencoe, Illinois, and it's a theater company that has been around for more than a decade. Everything they do, everything they touch turns to gold. You know, the best productions ever of A Streetcar Named Desire, one fantastic hit after another, highly acclaimed, huge attendance. It's in Glencoe. You know, it's 45. If you live in Chicago and want to get there, it's a complete ordeal. It's in 45 minutes away, and unless you have a Lexus, it's impossible. I don't think they'll let you into Glencoe unless you're driving a Lexus. They have
at least a Lexus.
They have armed guards at the borders of Glencoe. But you know, it's quite a Tony crowd. A few years ago, we saw the audience participation version of A Streetcar Named Desire there, which was highly acclaimed. So they get, this is in a small, smallish, very wealthy suburb. They're building a new theater, and I think the budget for the theater is $37 million.
It's something around that, yeah.
So they're halfway through constructing the famous architect, and it catches on fire.
I have a friend who's the business manager up there, and they spent a great deal of time raising the money for this, and apparently some sort of styrofoam insulation or something on the roof caught on fire after some electrical work or some welding work was happening. It was quite smoky and very noticeable and visible all over the community. But apparently, certainly no one was injured. I think maybe
easily repaired and worked around.
Apparently so. I think it's all going to be just fine, which is good because I'm really excited about seeing something up there in this new space. It's always fun to go to a new
space. Do we know what they're going to have?
They haven't announced it yet. They're still trying to, you know, get through this season in sort of borrowed spaces. They're doing Doubt in a church, for instance.
That's
right. Right inside a church.
Hey, I said, did you see the review?
I did not.
There was a review in the Tribune, and I think it was a favorable review. And they said it's being performed in a church. And they said, by no surprise, it is not a Catholic church. It's being performed in a Protestant church because I don't think the Catholic church would welcome that show.
Surprise, yeah. It's not in some...
Holy Name Cathedral presents our production of Doubt, an anti-Catholic play in which a priest might have done something really bad, but maybe didn't. But the nun has doubts.
Now, you mentioned the fact that we saw Streetcar Named Desire Writers Theater a few years ago, which was a wonderful production, sort of in the round, not quite in the round. It was like two-sided with this long set right diagonally across the middle of the room and an audience on both sides of
it. Well, sort of on three sides. So you could, you could see, you know, two-thirds of the audience from wherever you sat.
It was a hilarious, night. You mentioned that it was audience participation.
Well, I have three memories. One of the things the directors did, which I thought was brilliant, is he wanted to cast a husband and wife as Stella and Stanley because he wanted Stanley to be really mean and abusive. And he didn't want to cast an, didn't want to put an actor in the role of having to be abusive towards a female actress physically and emotionally, really I can't think of another word than abusive. So he said, if I do it with a husband and wife, it'll be okay because they'll be physically comfortable with each other and I won't have to deal with the psychology of and you know, complaints from Actors Equity. So it was all stops out. I mean, the guy who played Stanley was, you know, built like a like he worked out a lot, like a house made of bricks. And he was just violent and mean and terrible. And I believe we saw a matinee, which tends to get the very trendy 85 plus crowd. So we were the young hip things at this particular performance.
We were absolutely the young hip things.
The youngest people in the audience. And at one point, the actor playing Stanley is screaming at Stella. And there's a pause in the action while Stanley's catching his breath. And from the front row, a 90-year-old man goes, "Oh, he's just a terrible man. I can't believe how he's talking to his wife." It's like, you're not at home watching TV. Everyone in the theater can hear you.
Yes. It's not the Amazing Race.
It's not the Amazing Race.
On Friday night. Come on.
And then later in the show where they encounter the flower seller. Flower seller is walking down the street. "Flores, flores, por los muertos." And the woman behind us says, "That means flowers for the dead." Yes, we know. Thank you. Thank you for filling in all 300 people gathered here today to watch this show.
And she said it very
plain,
full voice.
As plain as day.
As if she were walking down the street.
As plain as day. And the third funny thing that happened is at one point Blanche is pouring a cocktail for Mitch, who's come to see her, and she's not in the best shape possible, and she miraculously, like as if she's been a waitress at a Rush Street bar for 30 years, is able to pour three cocktails and carry them in one hand. And someone else behind us goes, "Look at that. She's carrying three drinks in one hand. That's very talented." Yes, it is. Stop talking. Oh, this happened to me again. I'm going to segue here. I complained about, on a previous broadcast, about the time I went to Carousel, the first time I saw Carousel. And anytime anything interesting happened, the woman in front of me had to uncap her plastic bottle of water and go glug, 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 glug.
We remember this, absolutely.
June is busting nut on glug, 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 glug.
Yep.
So we haven't gotten to this yet. I'm jumping. I go see the Ballet of Scotland?
I was going to push you in that direction. Went to see the Royal Ballet of Scotland, yeah. And you saw?
And I saw their production of A Streetcar Named Desire. So I'm jumping, and we can get into the specifics of this production in a little bit. What happens at this show? Every time it reaches a high point, dramatic moment, oh, poor Blanche DuBois, she's losing her mind, she's in great distress. What does the woman in front of me have to do? Uncap her bottle, glug, 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 glug. So what is this? Is there some connection previously unexplored between dramatic things happening on stage and lowly dowagers needing to glug water from their Evian bottle that they have smuggled into the theater?
Perhaps your presence makes people thirsty.
Perhaps. I don't think it had anything to do with me, but is it something, is there some trigger that, is it an oral thing, the need for water? Something happens on stage and I get nervous and have to shove something in my mouth.
Well, or they just feel uncomfortable with the conflict that they're seeing. A lot of people don't like conflict and it makes them have to be active to do something. Reach in their purse or pick up a bottle of water or shift in their chair. I mean, shifting in your chair is usually the kind of thing that a lot of people do, but you happen to encounter people who need to hydrate.
Okay, that's it. Hello, I'm Ross Fraser. Perhaps you'll need to hydrate in the next hour that we spend sitting near each other in a theater.
And so how was the production? This is it's kind of an odd piece to translate into ballet.
You know, for me to opine about the ballet makes about as much sense as for me to get into talking about...
Well, I'm not going to ask your opinion on how the pliés and the jetés went. Just in a dramatic structure, I think you're eminently qualified to comment on that.
I'm glad I went. I had a great seat. It was interesting enough. I'm not sure why you take one of the five greatest plays ever written by an American that is probably most famous for the poetry of the language and the brilliance of the writing, and you think, I'm going to take this great play and I'm going to put it in a new format where, guess what? We strip out all the dialogue. So that no one can possibly understand anything that's happening.
So when Blanche is opining about how she's always dependent upon the kindness of strangers, how do they dramatize that?
Well, for the purposes of the ballet, you know, there are 15 pages of program notes that you can read ahead of time so you can understand what you're going to see on stage. So you see all of Blanche's backstory, and you're probably 40 minutes into the production before you finally get to the point where the play began. So they have a number of sequences where she falls upon hard times, and as she's pirouetting and dancing en pois, you know, people dressed on like come on stage dressed like cowboys in overalls and hand her large sums of cash and then dance provocatively with her, and you sort of get the impression that she has been paid for her companionship. So towards the end, there is a sequence in which all of this comes back to haunt her, and we see all of the men that she's ever known who dance around her and throw cash at her while she spins on the bed and acts crazy, including the character of
she actually
her.
Spin on the bed.
Yes, she jumps around on the bed.
I see.
And including, this goes on forever, her husband, who she catches in a compromising position with another man, has shoots himself off stage, and of course in the play version, he's never seen. In the ballet version, he frequently flounces onto the stage in a bloodstained shirt. And so we're subjected to that repeatedly. The other absurdity is it's the National Ballet of Scotland, the Scottish Ballet. I read through the program notes because they have no cast list. So you don't know who's dancing what role. Mm. And as you read through the cast list, it's, you know, Mona Ashburn is from Berkeley, California. Tom Finney is from Nova Scotia. And the sad truth is that there are no Scottish people, in fact, in the Scottish Ballet.
Did it make you miss your previous career as a ballet dancer?
I thought we weren't going to talk about that on air.
Sorry, I know it ended tragically. You went with some friends to this. Did they know anything about this play, about the show?
I went with two very educated women with whom I work, who are very bright. One of them has a master's degree from the University of Chicago. She had never seen Streetcar Named Desire and was completely unfamiliar with it. The other woman who I went with, who I might secretly be dating, and we can talk about that later, her name is Jessica. I have a little bit of a crush on her. It's a long story, and it will also be doomed. But she, when she decided to get tickets to this, she downloaded the movie and watched it so that she would have an appreciation for it. So the first woman who I spoke of, the University of Chicago graduate, who remained unnamed, Amy, and I explained the plot to her. She said, are you describing the plot of that Woody Allen movie that Cate Blanchett won the Oscar for? And I said, well, yes, I am. Sort of, in fact, I am. But this is what we've come to as Americans, where Woody Allen movies have now replaced Tennessee Williams plays as...
Blue Jasmine. Well, I'm glad you went. It's always good to get another cultural perspective on things happening around Chicago. And, you know, let's face it, you're not going to see something like this every day.
No, and especially in the Harris Theater, where I was roughly halfway through to the core of the earth, because when you go to the Harris Theater, you have to walk down seven flights of stairs into the sub-basement of sub-basements, where there's actually a very nice performance space.
Well, when the Chinese launch that nuclear attack, I hope I'm watching a show at the Harris Theater. theater, because we'll be perfectly safe. Yes. We will not know a thing that's going on.
And one of the nice things about being there is you never have to worry about cell phones going off, because there is no cell phone reception 100 miles below the surface.
They can't even install anything underneath there. There's no way a satellite is going to even reach that depth.
No.
We have some things coming up in the next maybe couple of months that could be of interest to our listeners. They'll be treated to the opening night of the Grant Park Music Festival. We're going to be on site for that.
Oh.
And we should be listening. It's the June 16th or 19th, 17th, I think. I'll let you know.
All right.
Is it classical music?
Won't be late.
It is a classical program. I believe they're playing some Beethoven or something. I don't want to speak about what they're playing without actually knowing it. I have the brochure here someplace, but I can look it up. And this is very exciting. In a couple of months, we may be appearing at the Taste of Chicago. They're going to be doing some podcasting live there.
And we will be there, live and in person.
We have been extended an invitation. Now, we're still considering that invitation, but I think pretty much we're probably going to say yes.
Why would we not?
Well, you know, maybe the money won't be right.
That could be. We also might be invited to participate at Taste of Paris that same weekend, and then there'll be tough decisions to make.
Or Taste of Nova Scotia.
Taste of Nova Scotia. Taste of Streetcar Named Desire.
Speaking of Streetcar Named Desire, it might be time for our Kiss of Death segment.
Oh.
I have a couple of interesting pieces here that I know that you'll have some comment on. Recently, we lost ex-governor of Illinois. Governor Dan Walker passed away. Not too many of our listeners will know much about Dan Walker. He was a combative populist who became Illinois governor. After condemning Chicago's reaction to the Democratic National Convention demonstrations as a, quote, a police riot, and later went to prison for bank fraud. Don't they all go to prison for bank fraud? He died. He was 92. He was described as either brilliant or phony by those who knew and watched him. The Democrat bested the revered Paul Simon. Paul Simon was a wonderful politician. In the 1972 Democratic primary for governor, beat the incumbent Republican, and some believe with the benefit of a different direction, could have been the 1976 presidential nominee. Interesting.
Wow.
He was brilliant, very, even excessively ambitious, said former U.S. Senator Adlai Stevenson III, whose first Senate campaign in 1970 Walker managed. You knew Dan Walker in some fashion, did you
not? Well, I had an encounter with him. At the time that he had gone to the penitentiary, as my mother would say, she often fears that I will one day end in the penitentiary, but that's a story for...
Maybe you'll be in the memorial Dan Walker cell.
Maybe I will be. So this is a true story. Some years ago, Dan Walker is in prison, and I worked in radio at the time for a radio network, and I did a weekly news magazine, and so every week we would just sort of think, well, what would be, you know, but do 3 segments, 8-minute stories. What should we do a story about? And someone said, let's do a story about, you know, what it's like to be in prison. Dan Walker's in prison. Let's interview Dan Walker.
Good idea.
So I call, I don't remember how I did this. I called Wizzy and Joliet. Isn't that where they all go, Joliet, Danville?
Possibly.
So I called the prison. I somehow got to him. And they said, well, you have to leave a message. And, you know, prisoners can't just make random phone calls. They will have to call you in a particular way. So a few days later, and this is some time ago, before this is in the early 1990s, when you know phone systems were antiquated and we didn't have the internet at work or instant messaging, we had an intercom system. So if you had a phone call, the secretary, we called them secretaries then, not administrative assistants, not to be pejorative. So my beloved Joyce, probably working in an open-air office with 50 people, suddenly across the intercom you hear, Roscoe, Governor Dan Walker is calling you from prison, collect on Park Zero. Roscoe, Governor Dan Walker is calling you collect from prison, he's on Park Zero. Hello, yes, I'll accept the charge.
And everybody in the office heard this.
Everyone in the office heard, and it was the funniest thing ever. But I got to interview him.
And how was he?
He was fine. Very gracious, very nice. And years later, I met his wife, at the opening night party, and I'm not making this up, this sounds absurd, something of a stretch. I met his wife at the opening night party for the play Legends, which was written by James Kirkwood and starred Mary Martin and Carol Channing and played at the Schubert Theater in Chicago. And inexplicably, she was there.
Wow.
And I was too nervous to talk to Mary Martin or Carol Channing. So instead, I talked to the poor wife of the imprisoned former governor, which is something a lot of people could do over the years.
It
if
is.
You ran into Mrs. Blagojevich.
Sure.
Or...
And just to be clear, Walker, after he left office, he took over a suburban Chicago savings loan where he was convicted of bank fraud in 1987. So he was not convicted of something he did while in office. There was no corruption charges or Blagojevich-like indictments in that way, and sentenced to 18 months in prison and forever categorized him with three other Illinois executives who have spent time behind bars in the past 40 years. You brought this obituary to my attention, Joshua Ozersky, food writer, 47.
Did you laugh at some point while reading this obituary?
I did. Joshua was a food blogger who translated Appetite and Ambition into columns, books, and international food festival called Meektopia. That was one point when I left. He died on Monday in Chicago, where he was to attend the annual James Beard Awards, and he was only 47, found in his hotel room, and an autopsy on Tuesday did not determine the cause of death yet. News of his death rippled through the crowd that gathered Monday night for the awards ceremony, a black tie affair at the Lyric Opera. Many of his friends there had last seen him at a karaoke lounge about 4 a.m. on Monday evening. He's well known and both loved and loved.
Yeah. So was he found 7 hours later?
Apparently.
Where is there a karaoke lounge in Chicago that's open at 4 a.m.?
Well, you could go to the Redheaded Piano Bar or, you know, one of those, Howl at the Moon type places. I'm sure there's plenty of places where you can find a 4 a.m. bar in downtown Chicago. Both Loved and Loathed is one of the most forceful food writers in the country, founding editor of New York Magazine's Grub Street blog and later a columnist for Time and Esquire. Mr. Ozersky wrote about restaurants, chefs, and food with conviction, humor, and attention to history. But it was his joyful willingness to be bluntly opinionated that won him sworn enemies and loyal friends, far more friends than enemies, in the ranks of chefs and restaurateurs. He mocked vegans and vegetarians and called out fellow food writers for accepting free meals, a practice that came back to haunt him in 2010. When Robert Sysema, then the Village Voice restaurant critic, criticized Mr. Ozersky for enlisting top chefs to cater his wedding reception free of charge. He was born Joshua Avram Ozersky in Miami in 1967, the only child of Anita and David Ozersky, a painter, who, according to Mr. Ozersky's autobiographical writings, had little professional ambition and less money, but took solace in sandwiches and spare ribs. The family moved to Atlantic City in 1979 so David Ozersky could take a union job as a stagehand at a casino. Soon afterward, Anita Ozersky died of an overdose of sedatives. Why does it always come down to, you know, Seek and All?
Why is that necessary?
I don't know.
I don't think they prescribe Seek and All anymore.
I don't think they can.
That's what killed Marilyn Monroe.
It did.
Stay away from the booze and the Seek and All, my father always said.
Yeah. Graduated from Rutgers University and began a PhD in American Studies at Notre Dame, but his love of food drew him back to New York City, where he began writing restaurant reviews for the Manhattan newspaper, the West Side Spirit, and Newsday. His first book, Meet Me in Manhattan, that's Meet, M-E-A-T, written under the pseudonym Mr. Cutlets, was a 2003 guide to the borough's best steaks, ribs, chops, sausages, and so on. Oh, doesn't that sound good? Right about now.
Right about now.
I could use some sausages and chops right about now.
I could use a large T-bone.
In it, he anticipated the meat-centric trend that would soon seize the nation's chefs. Meatopia, a gathering that began as a book party for Meet Me in Manhattan, has grown to attract thousands of meat lovers in different cities, despite being plagued by epic heat, rain, and disorder. I didn't get that part, but apparently, they've not had any luck.
This obituary is full of things that have not that aren't really explained.
Last year,
like why is there so much disorder? What is the disorder?
Yeah,
I don't know. Move on.
Rain and heat. Last year, Mr. Ozersky formed a partnership with the food festival impresario Lee Schrager to stage Meatopia in New York and Miami Beach as part of those cities' annual food events, where Mr. Ozersky, in his signature Buddy Holly eyeglasses, was a fixture. You know, I stage managed the original Broadway production of Buddy Holly. Did I ever tell you that?
I believe you did.
Yeah, Buddy Holly.
Oh, and what was the story? Not to interrupt this obituary, you had a story about the Buddy Holly ended with like a 20-minute music set.
Yeah, 25 minutes.
And one day, the curtain parted.
Clear Lake.
And a very famous person showed up to play the keyboards that night.
Yeah, Paul Hipp was playing Buddy Holly. Fantastic performance. One of the great performances that I've seen in my lifetime. Young kid, but he was fantastic in it. We started this production in Canada. Did it in a couple of cities there before bringing it to New York. And
To
Broadway. At the end of the show, they would play a mock Clear Lake concert, which was the last concert that Buddy played with the Big Bopper and Richie Valens before they got on that ill-fated plane and crashed in a farm field in Iowa. But they would do a whole concert. And it was about 20 to 25 minutes long, sometimes a tiny bit longer, depending on how the audience reaction was going. Frequently, I had to bring the curtain down because if we'd gone past 11 o'clock, we have to pay the stagehands a whole extra hour of overtime. So if Paul...
And the audience was probably going nuts.
Going crazy. And if Paul Hipp was feeling it, he would play encore after encore of something or other. And we'd have to bring the curtain in because otherwise, well, the producer would have been furious. One night, we start the Clear Lake concert sequence, and I look up, and one of our keyboardists, we had two keyboardists, one on either side of the stage on these big risers, one of our keyboardists leaves the stage, and somebody else comes up on stage and is behind the keyboard. And I'm like, what's going on there? And Paul Hippie's playing, and he hears that the keyboards aren't really sounding the way they usually sound, and he looks behind it. It's Carole King. Carole King shows up to play keyboards behind Paul
Hipp. My Lord.
I think she had a big crush on him.
Wow.
And I think they may have actually been seeing each other for a little while after that. But it was absolutely thrilling. Stuff like that happened to me all the time back in my younger days.
But moving right along.
Anyway.
What happened to Paul Hipp?
I haven't been able to track Paul down. He moved to Los Angeles to try to start a film career. It was a striking-looking young man, really tall. Lanky, looked just like Buddy, could play the guitar and act and dance and sing. He was just a multi-talented kind of guy. John Currents, the chef at the grocery at Oxford, Mississippi, and a longtime friend of Mr. Ozersky, said he was eating and drinking with Mr. Ozersky from Sunday night into Monday morning when Mr. Ozersky was enjoying himself at the karaoke lounge. Just like always, Josh didn't want the night to end, and he kept grabbing the mic, Mr. Currents said. The moment he will remember, he said, was when Mr. Ozersky belted out the Dolly Parton part in the romantic duet Islands in the Stream with the chef Jason Stanhope of Fig in Charleston, South Carolina. It was a beautiful, sweaty moment of pure joie de vivre. You don't hear that very often.
No.
Anyway, Joshua Ozersky, unfortunately dead, 47 years old, food writer.
I'm assuming if you're eating lots of meat and then you're singing Islands in the Stream at 4 o'clock in the morning, your heart just probably pooped out. But what a way to go.
Well, something pooped out.
Yeah.
And
leads us back to our opening segment.
They haven't, indeed. Yeah, something pooped out. Mm. Or we could go, you know, the manure expo. I was pooped.
I was pooped. I was pooped.
How'd you enjoy the manure expo, Roscoe?
Oh, it was fantastic. We walked and walked and walked, and I was absolutely pooped by the time it was over.
We should send this in.
We should.
We could be on the back of that T-shirt.
Yes, and I got some good fertilizer for my geraniums that I bought at the Flower and Garden Show.
Ross, do you know who Jean Evelyn Slutsky was?
Is she the 101-year-old actress?
No.
Then I don't know.
She was born Jean Evelyn Slutsky in Brooklyn on October 12th, 1923. You don't hear that very often. Mm. The daughter of David and May Rodden Slutsky, her father was a cab driver and her mother a manicurist. Her compulsive eating habits began as a child, she recalled in a memoir.
I do know. Now I know.
She never ate dessert in public, but at night, by the dim light of the refrigerator, she gorged on goodies. One day in 1961, Jean, a 214-pound Queens housewife with a 44-inch waist and an addiction to cookies by the box, ran into a neighbor at the supermarket. "Oh, Jean, you look so good," the neighbor said. "When are you due?" "I don't remember, but I'm positive that whenever I cried, my mother gave me something to eat," she once wrote. "I'm sure that whenever I had a fight with the little girl next door, or it was raining and I couldn't go out, or I wasn't invited to a birthday party, my mother gave me a piece of candy to make me feel better." Jean and her younger sister Helen grew up chubby and struggled physically and emotionally to control their weight. But Jean was a talker and popular in a circle of overweight friends. She graduated from Girls High School in Brooklyn and joined the Internal Revenue Service as a clerk in 1942.
Well, that'll drive you to eat.
In 1947, after a two-year courtship largely spent gourmandizing, you don't see that word very often.
Gourmandizing.
She married Mortimer Nietich. They had two children. The marriage ended in divorce in 1971. She was married again for a few months to a bass player she met on a cruise in 1975. After several years in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Warren, Pennsylvania, the Nietich family settled in a modest apartment in Little Neck, Queens in 1952, and Mortimer became an airport bus driver. Mrs. Nietich raised funds for charitable groups, including the North Hills League for, and I'm not making this up, it's right here in print, including the North Hills League for Retarded Children, and was president for 2 years. That was the name. She ate compulsively. She tried pills, hypnosis, and fad diets, but cycles of weight loss and gain went on. In 1961, after encountering the woman she thought was pregnant, she went to a city obesity clinic. For 10 weeks, she pretended to follow its diet, but she was obsessed with Malamars, chocolate-covered marshmallow cookies, if you don't know what those are. She hid them in the hamper and at night gorged on them in the bathroom. Trapped in a gluttonous secret life, she decided she had to confide in someone. She invited six friends, all overweight women, to her home for what turned into a group confessional, an exorcism of caloric demons that was the formal beginning of Weight Watchers. They all went on a diet, pledging mutual help through the abysses of anxiety, doubt, and gnawing hunger. Gnawing hunger. You know that feeling.
Constantly.
It worked. They soon brought more overweight friends to the meetings. Within 2 months, 40 women were attending. In October 62, Mrs. Nietich reached her goal of 142 pounds and vowed to undertake a mission to help others lose weight. With Felice and Albert Lippert, an overweight couple she had helped, she and her husband formed a corporation, and Weight Watchers was born in a loft over a movie theater in Little Neck, New York, in May 1963. The original Weight Watchers diet was a nutritionally balanced regimen recommended in city obesity clinics. Lean meat, fish, skim milk, and fruits and vegetables. It banned alcohol, sweets, and fatty foods. But the crucial ingredient was psychological. Journals to keep track of what one ate, diets with realistic goals, and lifelong maintenance programs, supportive magazines and books, television forums, camps, and meetings like those for alcoholics, with confessions and motivational speakers. The business boomed, of course. Hundreds of franchises were organized around the world. By 1968, 5 million people had enrolled. Mr. Lippert handled the business, and Mrs. Nietich was its public image. She became a dynamic speaker and a role model whose background and common touch sincerity captivated listeners. "If I can do it, anybody can do it," was her message. "We ourselves hold the instrument that makes us fat," she said, waving an imaginary fork in a 2011 interview with the Sun Sentinel of South Florida. "I just shake my head when I see someone eating cake and saying, oh, I wish I wasn't heavy, but they keep eating the cake." Jean Nietich, 91, dead, founder of Weight Watchers.
Wow. Did she keep the weight off all those years?
All those years, she kept the weight off. She always looked great. She always looked glamorous. She had this big head of golden hair. Here's a picture of her in 1983 with these gigantic glasses and this big gold hair.
Wow. You know, it where I work, we have one of my traumas one day is that on Wednesdays at noon, there's a Weight Watchers meeting in the large conference room and Bible study in the small conference room. And I thought, gosh, what do I do today? So I did the only thing that made sense. I walked 2 blocks to the nearest Popeyes and got a 3-piece extra spicy. I was happy, but boy, is that expensive these days.
I bet it is. Do you remember our Kiss of Death obituary last week of Vivian Nicholson, the spend winner of the...
Yes, fantastic.
...of the lottery or the sweepstakes and 1961 when she won all those millions and then yes. just went on this huge spree.
And she bought clothes to match her car and cars to match her clothes.
We were remarking about how beautifully written that obituary was, not just because it was the fascinating subject matter, but how well a piece of reporting and journalism that it was. It was written by a woman named Marguerite Fox. Marguerite is a senior writer at the New York Times, a journalist. She wrote literary criticism for years and now does write an occasional obituary. Well, she's written another one that I came across, and it's almost equally as beautifully written.
Fantastic.
I would read some to you.
I won't interrupt.
Patachou died at 96. A chanteuse of sharp shears was the headline.
Say it again.
Patachou, a Parisian chanteuse who built a reputation on an offbeat name, a penchant for guillotining men's ties, and the fact that she does not look, act, or croon like Edith Piaf, as the New York Times put it in 1958, died back in April at her home in Neuilly-sur-Seine, outside Paris. She was 96 years old. A petite ribald domino. Patachou was one of the most renowned French singers of the post-war period, known for her deep, husky voice, warm, earthy manner, and amiably irreverent stage persona. Where Piaf conveyed haunted, wraith-like glamour, Patachou, with her robust build and habitual performing attire of navy blue skirt and white blouse, looked like nothing so much as a favorite school teacher. Piaf's stock in trade was pain. Patachou, as Nan Robertson continued in her article in the New York Times, preferred songs of Paris streets, Paris gamins, Paris carnivals, Paris lovers on park benches, and Parisians who put kittens inside their bodices to attract male attention. She sang in nightclubs around the world, including those at the Waldorf Astoria and the St. Regis Hotels in New York, as well as at Carnegie Hall and on Broadway. In later years, she acted in films by Jean Renoir and Sacha Guitry. Her stage name is a condensation of pâté à choux, the French term for cream puff dough. That, Mrs. Robertson wrote, is roughly the equivalent of Doris Day taking on the pseudonym of Ready Mix Batter. Patachou, and it's spelled P-A-T-A-C-H-O-U, was born Henrietta Eugenie Jean Regon in Paris on June 10th in 1918, right after the war. As a young woman, she was a typist and a factory worker. In 1948, she and her first husband, Jean Billon, took over Chez Patachou, a restaurant and cabaret in the Montmartre district of Paris. There, despite the nightly presence of a pianist and an accordionist, the place was echoingly empty. Then one night in 1950, Mrs. Billon joined the few patrons in singing along to the music. One of them asked her to perform a solo, and she, who had never studied voice or sung a note in public, gamely obliged, singing Le Saint, just like a woman sings to herself in the bathroom, she told the Times. Do you want your place full every night? The customer implored her afterward. Then sing. Within 3 months, Chez Patachou was required reservations 2 weeks in advance. It was soon presenting some of the foremost names in French song, including young lions like Jacques Brel, Charles Aznavour, Georges Brassens, along with Piaf herself. Audience participation was roundly encouraged, and those who abstained paid a sartorial price. One night, a patron asked for a pair of scissors, and before anyone could stop him, took them to the necktie of his non-singing table mate. It was funny, Patachou told the Times, but I liked it. Was not funny, she said, but I liked the look of terror on the man's face. After that, I too cut ties when a man does not sing with me. It gives me a feeling of power. Over time, a forest of truncated ties sprouted from the cafe's rafters, including one separated from Errol Flynn, the international playboy Ali Khan, King Farouk of Egypt, and Governor Thomas E. Dewey of New York. Patachou, whose marriage to Mr. Bion ended in divorce, later married the theatrical producer Arthur Lesser, who died before her. Her survivors include a son, singer-songwriter Pierre Bion, who wrote I Forgot to Live for Johnny Holiday. As an actress, she appeared in Renoir's French Cancan, Guitry's Napoleon, and many other French films and television shows. On Broadway, she was featured in the revue's International Soirée in 1958 and Folies Bergères in 1964. Patachou had made her New York debut on January 3rd, 1953, at the Empire Room of the Waldorf Astoria. That night, Mrs. Robertson wrote in the Times, she snipped not a single tie. I thought that was beautifully written by Marguerite Fox.
It's fantastic.
Have you ever heard of Patachou?
I have, in fact.
You are, in fact, an aficionado of some sort of cabaret singing and that kind of style. Mm-hmm. What do you know of her?
I just really know the name. And what intrigued me, and I think we need to give a little teaser to inspire people to tune in to our next broadcast, in which I promise you we will dig out the lyrics for and perform a song I've never heard of, which you just mentioned, which is called I Forgot to Live. Perhaps we'll have an offshoot podcast. I Forgot to Live, the Roscoe story.
In French, and I don't speak French, but it's J'ai oublié de vivre. J'ai oublié de vivre. I Forgot to Live. I think we need to break that out. And
At
least you need to do a rendition of that.
I think so. You know, when I was young and first coming to Chicago, there was a fancy restaurant called Tango in the Belmont Hotel, Belmont and Sheridan. And the hostess there was a French chanteuse named Bricktop, whose career had started in the 20s. And she was still around in the 1970s. And I saw her there. And she would seat people and greet people and walk around. And then, you know, once a while, stand in the middle of the restaurant and break into song.
Sort of like our waitress at Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yes.
Oh, here's your tip. Now go sing I Don't Know How to Love Him, please.
Yes. Here's your double vodka, sir. Now I have to get back on the stage. All French chanteuses. How do you pluralize chanteuse?
Let's just say chanteuse.
Chanteuse. They all have one name. Bricktop, Hildegard.
Piaf,
well, she was Edith Piaf, Patachou. And I have a story which might be too long for our purposes now about a friend of mine whose grandfather had an affair with Hildegard, who was a famous French chanteuse who performed, what's the Pink Hotel that's been torn down that everyone still cries about? The Edgewater Beach Hotel. Hildegard regularly performed there, and she was quite a sensation as a French chanteuse, despite the fact that she grew up in Milwaukee and had never, in fact, been to France. And with that, I close.
Well, that's a good point to close on. We hope you enjoyed our podcast. We hope you found interest in the various cultural and amusing topics that we wandered our way through. I think it was a little bit rambling today, but we covered an awful lot of ground.
We moved fast.
Quickly.
So even if you didn't care about what we were talking about, it's zip, zip, zip.
We're on to the next thing.
Pow, pow, on to the next thing. It's one topic after another.
As always, I have enjoyed my time with you, Roscoe.
Well, as have I.
The sincerity is just dripping.
No, I have, and I'm just eager to run over to the turntable and put on some French chanteuse music.
Let's do that, shall we?
We shall.
Until next time, thanks for tuning in.
Hold me close and hold me fast. La di da do javon, la di salivion rosa. Ha ha ha.